In December of 1930, Salem made national headlines when a feud between two families migrated from Tennessee into southern Indiana, resulting in two deaths, four injuries, and two trials. The affair will now be described by witnesses and participants in the affair.
I never heard too much about the Spurlocks or the Gibsons these last 12 years or so, excepting when some of the Spurlocks moved up here from Tennessee around 1918, and some members of the Gibson clan followed in that same year. But then again, in those days, it wasn't too unusual for many families to move into an area from the same part of the country. Those two families settled out near the settlement of Little York in Nob Hill Country.
What I heard was the Spurlock-Gibson feud began because of some petty quarrel that happened over 20 years before the events of 1930. I heard that one of the Gibsons even said that it may have been over a liquor dispute. All I know for sure is that for all this time fighting, an all-out warfare would break out between the two families on occasion.
But I never heard much about a feud for all of this time that the Spurlocks and Gibsons have lived in Washington County. I may have heard once or twice that the families didn't get along, but I never expected for any blood to be drawn.
But I don't know what else was to be expected. From what I heard, around the beginning of December, old Pat Gibson, the 70-year-old leader of the Gibson clan, was in town boasting that he had just come back from Tennessee where he killed some more Spurlocks. And you know what? I believe that he had it in him to do it. Patton Gibson was a fairly large man with a forceful character, and even more so, he was inclined to handle liquor. I heard that he carried a silver dollar for every man that he killed in his life, adding up to six in all. Along the same lines, I also heard he carried a .45 Colt revolver with six notches on it. Granted, I know a lot of people who counted Patton Gibson as a friendly and hardworking man, but I know that I would have never wanted to be on his bad side. Anyway, Patton was bragging about killing some Spurlocks, and John and Please Spurlock heard Patton's talk. They wanted to take revenge for his actions and boasting. I also heard some talk that the brothers believed that Patton Gibson had done them dirt by breaking off some sort of moonshine deal. So on December 14th, and 36-year-olds confronted Patton near Martha Bell's house near Little York. I'll let Martha herself describe what happened at that confrontation.
I heard heated conversation outside, so I went to the window to look out on the scene. Patton Gibson was standing outside of his nearby house, facing Please and John Spurlock, while two of John's sons watched out from his car. I heard Patton exclaim, "You're fooling with the wrong man," before drawing his shotgun, but the brothers had split apart and drawn their own guns at the same moment. A moment later, there was a shot, as Please had managed to shoot Patton from behind. Patton stood for a moment before sinking to the ground. The brothers approached Patton Gibson and took his gun. Right after the shot, Gibson's wife, a French woman that he brought back with him after serving in France during the Great War, ran out of their house and charged at the Spurlocks, yelling, "Give me his gun! Give me his gun!" The Spurlocks complied, but with Angeline Gibson turned her attention to her fallen husband, John and Please Spurlock returned to their cars and fled the scene. At that moment, I decided to call Washington County Sheriff Milt Trinkle out to the scene.
It was nearly dark when I reached the Bell home, and Gibson's body had been moved to his two-story frame house about a quarter of a mile away. There I found the widow and other relatives holding a wake over the body. From Mrs. Gibson and Mrs. Bell, I obtained detailed information of the shooting. I also learned that Bill Gibson, the oldest son of the slain man, had gathered a posse and was searching for the fleeing Spurlocks. I knew that I had to do all that was in my power to avoid further bloodshed between the families, so I got in touch with all of the surrounding cities in an effort to get the word out about the fugitives. I had police at New Albany and Louisville guard the Duke Bridge over the Ohio River, and with other officers, I searched a farm where the Spurlocks had been tenants, but we only found evidence of a hasty fight. Luckily, though, about a week later, John and Plez finally gave themselves up to Sheriff Joe Courtney at Hagen, Virginia, because they grew weary of being stalked. I traveled to Hagen, Virginia with two companions to bring the Spurlocks back to Salem for a trial. We brought the Spurlocks back to Salem and lodged them in the Washington County Jail on first-degree murder charges. The brothers were well behaved on the trip back to Indiana and expressed a desire for an early trial. They seemed confident that they would be cleared in court on a showing of self-defense. John Spurlock told me, "It was a case of either kill or get killed. He pulled a gun on us and told us he would kill both of us. We had to beat him to the trigger pull to save our lives." We believed that the situation was calming down as inclement weather set in and a trial was scheduled, but that wasn't the end of it. On Saturday, the 28th of December, Otis, Guilford, Dan, and Alonzo Gibson stormed the Washington County Jail in an effort to seize John and Plez Spurlock for their own revenge in the murder of their father. When they arrived at the jail, they demanded that my wife and I hand over the keys to the cell that John and Plez were being held in. My wife will help me recount that night's events.
My husband and I finished eating dinner about 6 that night. Suddenly, I heard a tramp of hurried feet on the porch. The snow was crunching under heavy footsteps. My husband started to rise when the front door in the hall was flung open violently. In piled a band of men. Every one of them was carrying a gun. My husband acknowledged to me that they were 4 sons of Patton Gibson, Otis, Guilford, Dan, and Alonzo. We didn't suspect that they would cause serious trouble at first, though.
Then Otis Gibson leaped straight at me, and his fingers closed around my necktie. He yanked me up from my chair, and the tie began choking me. He yelled, "Give me the damn keys to the jail," and I could smell the whiskey on his breath. He was pressing a revolver against my side. I knew that I needed to stall for time because the keys to the big steel door, but thankfully not to the cells, were hanging on a nail in plain view, less than 3 feet behind me. I told them that I could not give them the keys because they were upstairs. I wanted to lead the boys away from my wife and the old kitchen cook in hopes that an alarm could be raised for help to come to the jail. Guilford yelled at Otis to let me go so that I could lead them upstairs, so Otis let go and remained downstairs while I led the other 3 away.
It seemed like forever that my husband was upstairs with those 3 madmen, though I'm sure it was only a couple of minutes. Just when I heard things start to get violent upstairs, though, Otis noticed the keys hanging on the hook and shouted to his brothers that he'd found them. When my husband returned downstairs with the other 3, Otis was triumphantly waving the keys in the air. I grew terrified that the Gibsons would force their way inside and kill Spurlock's brothers before the law had a chance to run its course. So I yelled, "Don't go in there and kill them! Give them a chance for their lives!" But it was no use. The brothers pushed us toward the steel door, and we had no choice but to finally agree to unlock the outer door, thinking maybe this might satisfy them. We didn't think they knew of the arrangements of the jail. 3 of the boys went inside with us, while Otis, the youngest, stayed outside. When we got inside, Otis Gibson barred the door, and we were locked in there with 3 of the brothers at the mercy of their shotguns.
The Spurlocks had been playing cards when they heard the commotion at the front of the building. They were in an L-shaped cell made of steel bars 1 inch thick. This cell was separated from the steel door at which the Gibsons were storming by a 4-foot aisle. To get to their cell, it was necessary to unlock first the all-steel sheet door, a second door completely made of steel, cross the aisle, and open the cell door. The Spurlocks must have realized that the commotions meant that the Gibsons had come to seek their own revenge because they had ripped up a floor plank within their cell and used it to reinforce the door to their cell. They had also put out their light and, as I later learned, crawled under the lower bunk in the back corner of the cell. It was impossible to see the lads. The Gibsons paced up and down the aisle, exclaiming such sentiments as, "Show us the damn swine!" But I attempted to stall for time and informed them that I did not know where the Spurlocks were.
I heard one of the Gibsons yell that if we didn't reveal the Spurlocks to them, that they would shoot us. And then I saw a shotgun pointing at us from a short distance down the aisle. I yelled, "Lord have mercy, don't do that!" But then Alonzo pulled the trigger of that gun. I felt the bullet pierce my leg, and the same bullet injured my husband's foot. We started yelling, and my husband shouted to Otis Gibson to let us out. We didn't know then that Mr. Gerald, the town marshal, had killed Otis Gibson. We kept yelling, and the 3 that were locked with us began talking among themselves. The old lady who stays with us finally came in and barred the door after Otis Gibson had been killed. The 3 Gibson boys fled, and Mr. Trinkle and myself got out the best we could the way we were shot up. Neither of us got seriously wounded. I got several shots in the leg from the shotgun, and it's pretty painful. It sure was a busy place around here for a while, and a mighty exciting time.
I later learned what was happening outside of the jail while Mrs. Trinkle and I were being held up. Charles Foster, a watchman for the Monon Railroad at a nearby crossing, had seen the Gibson brothers getting out of their car near the jail. He had noticed that each of the four brothers carried a shotgun, so he rushed to inform the radio dealer across the street what he suspected was going to happen at the jail. The radio dealer decided to call in a fire alarm so that a crowd would gather at the jail in a timely manner.
Sure enough, as Salem's fire truck came dashing up with its screaming siren, people began running toward the jail from all sides. A fire run in a small town is a big event.
At that moment, Otis Gibson stepped out of the jail building and onto the porch. He shot toward the fire truck and demanded that it move. The driver complied with Otis' wishes. At that same moment, Elmer Gerald, the town marshal, was half a block down the street at the Indiana Theater, viewing a Wild West movie thriller. It was Mrs. Gerald that heard of the alarm that the jail was being held up and rushed to the theater to inform her husband.
After my wife informed me of the events happening at the jail, I rushed to the scene as quickly as I could. When I arrived, I marched right up to the front steps of the jail porch. Otis warned me to stay back, but I continued to close in on him. I grabbed Otis's gun with my left hand and started pulling out my own gun with my right hand. In the struggle for each of us to gain possession of the other's gun, Otis pulled the trigger of his gun and the bullet struck me right in the abdomen. I fell to the ground and I was in immense pain, but I was determined to do all that I could. I began firing on Otis, and my first shot struck Otis in the heart, killing him instantly. By this time, Gilfred, Dan, and Alonzo had been let out of jail, and they slipped out past the Crown during the ensuing commotion.
An alarm was immediately sounded to search for the three brothers at large, and not only did the city fire department take part in the search, but also 200 volunteers. As winter grew more harsh, our searches were underway. During this time, it was decided for John and Pleas Spurlock to be moved to the Jeffersonville jail for their own safety. I led a posse to Gilfred Gibson's farm, and when we got there, he walked out with his hands in the air and simply said, "I'll come peaceful, so long as you ain't got no Spurlocks with you." Imagine. Gilfred's trial was set to take place in New Albany on April 7th, and he was released on a $1,000 bail. But the search was still on for Dan and Alonzo Gibson. Shoot, Salem almost looked like a military encampment, as posses of deputies and war veterans were deployed to search for the fugitives over several townships. Lieutenant John C. Weir of the state police set a trap to catch Don and Alonzo on the Jade Collins farm near the Kentucky border one night, but those sly brothers were able to escape, so the search continued. A posse of American Legion men under former Sheriff Charles Moore trailed the brothers for several days, but those boys managed to keep just ahead of the posse by watching the searchers from opposite hills and by taking refuge with friends in the district to the northeast of Salem. At one point in the search, the party thought they were close to capturing the brothers when it was reported that smoke had been seen rising from an abandoned farmhouse, but that turned out to be false information. We never actually found Dan and Alonzo Gibson. They remained fugitives until March 29, 1932, when they actually turned themselves in to me. A short time later, Gilfred joined his brothers, and the three stated they wished to plead guilty. The three were brought before Circuit Judge W.W. Hoddle, and they pleaded guilty to charges of breaking and entering into my jail in an attempt to commit a felony. Judge Hoddle sentenced each brother to serve 1 to 10 years in the state reformatory at Pendleton, Indiana. I took the three brothers to the Pendleton Institution without delay. Meanwhile, let us briefly return to 1931, when John and Pleas Spurlock went on trial for the murder of Patton Gibson. The trial of the Spurlocks opened in the Jackson County Circuit Court at Brownstown on October 14, 1931. The brothers received a bodyguard of well over 10 qualified individuals to ensure that they would not be harmed while in transit to court. Although the Spurlocks made a case of self-defense, On October 21st, the jury found the brothers guilty of manslaughter. Although the defense tried to move for a new trial, this was overturned and the Spurlocks were sentenced to serve 2 to 21 years in the state prison at Michigan City, and thus justice had been served to both families and quiet has now settled once more over our county.
You can still see the building that served as Washington County's jail at that time. It is the yellow 19th century style building located off the south side of the city square on the South Main Street. It should also be mentioned that the oldest Gibson son, William Gibson, who was later shot on October 31st of 1940 while leaving from the grand jury room in the Washington County Courthouse. The meeting of the grand jury in question was to investigate a disturbance that had occurred the previous Saturday at a tavern in Millport owned by William Gibson, which it had ended with William firing a shot into an automobile occupied by Archbishop's son. Although no one had been injured, Bishop apparently wanted revenge for the assault on his son's life. William had been serving as a witness when he emerged, only to be fatally shot with a .38 caliber pistol by Archbishop, who had also just served as a witness in the case. Sheriff Charles W. Moore witnessed the shooting and was able to immediately disarm Bishop, but he was too far away from Bishop to prevent the murder. Upon detainment, Bishop admitted to the murder and was placed in jail, the same jail that William Gibson's brother had attempted to assault just 9 years before. Today, every time the large swinging door to the courthouse creaks open due to the air pressure in the courthouse, the court staff will remark, "That is the ghost of Soldier Bill."